community has shown a genuine concern for the traumatic conditions faced by the people, physicians, and paramedics in Gaza, despite the fact that the international community has largely ignored the ongoing humanitarian crisis there.
Gaza has been the site of one of the largest conflicts, revealing a deeply traumatizing reality. We felt it was essential to honor the physicians and paramedics who sacrificed their lives on the battlefield.
Regarding the Israeli war on Gaza and Lebanon, I can say that we have international relations with doctors in both regions via teleconference. We will also discuss how trauma can be prevented and treated, particularly considering the daily trauma experienced by the oppressed children of Gaza.
As medical professionals dedicated to saving lives, we find it inconceivable. Explosives were discovered in tools and equipment. Pagers designed by the Israeli regime blinded hundreds of Lebanese.
Iranian hospitals have always been ready to help, and the healthcare assistance they offer this time is no different.
The injured brought to Iran after the pager blast received full coverage by the Iranian healthcare system. Appropriate actions were taken for them. Iranian hospitals treated over 500 injured Lebanese people.
In its genocidal war on Gaza and Lebanon, Israel has not spared even hospitals, leading to a tsunami of trauma among the people, medical professionals, paramedics, and most importantly, children. The Trauma Congress is an opportunity to discuss exactly that.
The ongoing conflict in Gaza has resulted in significant devastation to the healthcare infrastructure. Conferences like this, centered on Gaza's health conditions, can raise global awareness of the dire humanitarian crisis in the blockaded territory. Mehdi Nourouzi, Tehran.
The future of peace and human rights in West Asia is the theme of an international conference held in the Iranian capital, Tehran, featuring diplomatic and scholarly guests from around the globe. This event addresses the ongoing developments in both the region and the world at large. Organized by an Iranian NGO dedicated to clarifying Iran's commitment to global peace, the conference aims to provide different perspectives regarding peace and human rights.
In response to media attacks and accusations against our country, we are organizing peace conferences through a non-governmental organization to highlight the Islamic Republic's commitment to peace.
The participants underscored that many international structures were created in the aftermath of World War II to address the needs of that era. But it is crucial for these frameworks to become adapted to contemporary realities. Additionally, the ongoing conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon were significant themes in the guests' presentations.
I stressed in my statement that regional issues should be solved by regional players, and peace should be sustained by the regional players, not by the external players.
Peace in West Asia is fragile. While some advocate for peace building through international law and institutions like the UN, Israel's violations of UN resolutions undermine the effectiveness of such approaches in the region.
The conference also offered speakers a platform to criticize the security arrangements in the West Asia region, expressing that they need significant reform. In this conference, Israel's presence in West Asia was identified as a major contributing factor to the ongoing instability and tensions, referred to as the main reason behind the current state of unrest in the region. Farzan Ashurian, Tehran.
To some, France is standing idly by as Gaza and its population are destroyed by what many consider to be Israeli genocide. Tabiazi is a Palestinian refugee from Gaza.
What I want from the French government and what I want from the French people and all of the world, just to give the Palestinians the same human rights. The Palestinians want to be free, just want to be has their freedom.
I want the French government to stop, completely cut all ties with Israel. I want the French government to recognize Palestine. I want the French government to stop being hypocrites and actually play a role in making the change.
Harsh words calling for tough actions, which are unlikely to be taken up by the government here. As Israeli artillery continues to pound Gaza and parts of South Lebanon, France says it no longer supplies Israelis with the military equipment being used on those two fronts. The statement met with skepticism by some. The visit of the highly controversial Israeli minister Bezalel Smotrich for a private gala seems set to go ahead, as does a football match later this week between France and Israel.
While sports are often seen as a unifying factor, this match is now under scrutiny as a potential flashpoint of unrest and protest, especially given the current situation in Lebanon and Palestine. Peter Hume at the Stade de France near Paris.
Francesca Albanese, the high-profile UN Special Rapporteur on a tour of British universities, paying a short visit to supporters outside London's Queen Mary University ahead of a speech inside. We asked her what message she had brought to the UK.
The UK is in breach of its international law obligations. It's in good companies because many countries are not abiding by international law right now. Israel is committing a genocide. It's not only me saying that. It's hundreds of legal experts, historians, genocide scholars, including from Israel. There are 30 experts of the United Nations saying that. There is the International Court of Justice recognizing the plausibility of a genocide. Why the UK is still trading weapons with Israel?
As she headed to the venue of her lecture, she was confronted by an Israel supporter who was escorted away by police.
There are two protests taking place, one by a small pro-Israel crowd accusing the UN rapporteur of anti-Semitism, and another one by a pro-Palestinian crowd who say they consider Francesca Albanese as a hero and a champion for human rights.
Since her arrival in the UK, the attacks on Ms. Albanese from pro-Israel groups have been relentless but futile. As the UN Special Rapporteur, Albanese has spent years reminding the world of what international law says about the rights and responsibilities of the occupier and the occupied. Ahead of her visit to the UK, she published a report accusing Israel of committing genocide and apartheid. That drew the wrath of not just Israel, but its main backer, the United States, with outgoing Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield accusing Albanese of anti-Semitism and calling for her dismissal from the UN. Israel's smear campaigns against Albanese predate October 7th. Not one to be silenced, she's gone in the other direction, and by doing so, inspired more global Palestine solidarity. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Banking system connected to Russia's Mir payment network, signaling a new chapter in Tehran-Moscow relations. The announcement made in a ceremony held in the Iranian capital Tehran, attended by the governor of Iran's central bank and the ambassador to Russia, all in line with a common objective, boosting bilateral ties.
As a valuable neighbor, Russia offers great potential for strong transactions, particularly with our shared perspectives on regional and international events. This positive step can foster increased trade and transactions and aligns with our goal to use national currencies and pursue de-dollarization in line with other BRICS members.
According to the officials in charge, the project consists of three phases. The first phase enables Iranian citizens to use their bank cards to withdraw cash from Russian ATMs in rubles. In the second phase, Russian citizens will be able to do the same in Iran. And in the third phase, Russian stores will be linked to Iranian POS terminals, while ATMs in Russia equipped with NFC technology will accept bank cards from Iran's Shetab network. As Iran and Russia forge stronger financial ties, their connected banking systems pave the way for smoother trade and transactions, with ongoing negotiations for an alternative payments messaging service aimed to serve as a replacement for the SWIFT banking system. This comes after the agreement to link Russia's Mir payment network to Iran's Shetab banking system was finalized in St. Petersburg in July.
3 years ago,
we introduced the notion of integrating Iran's card payment networks with those of other nations, circumventing Western imposed sanctions. We are delighted that Russia has joined us in this endeavor, as a project initially projected to span a decade was accomplished in a mere year and a half.
Russia launched the Mir payment system in 2017 as an alternative to international financial services such as Visa and MasterCard. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
These are the local Shia tribesmen from Pakistan's Kurram tribal region protesting against the closure of a key route connecting them with the rest of the country. It has been more than a month since this essential passage was blocked, isolating the Kurram tribal region with Parachinar at its heart. This has triggered a severe humanitarian crisis in the area near the border with Afghanistan. The closure of this essential passage following recent attacks by pro-Takfiri militant groups that had left over 50 Shia Muslims dead has isolated the district, leading to severe shortages of vital medical supplies and essential commodities, halted educational activities, and severely disrupted daily life.
We are in bad situation because the line order situation here has happened more than 2 weeks. The road is closed. The medicine shortage is on a first stage. I kindly request the government institution, please involve in this situation, give a solution, especially for medicine, because the health is more important than everything. The first thing is health.
The road closures and militant attacks have made life unbearable for us. My small shop, which once thrived by selling daily essentials, now stands half empty. Supplies haven't arrived for weeks, and prices for whatever little is available have shot up.
The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan has expressed serious concerns over the humanitarian crisis in Parachinar, urging the government to take immediate action to alleviate the suffering of residents.
The government of Pakistan, along with provincial authorities, must urgently reopen the roads to recover from the humanitarian situation in the region and deploy all available resources to prevent cross-border militant attacks from neighboring Afghanistan to maintain peace in Parachinar.
While assuring that the key route will be reopened soon, authorities have stated that the closure was necessary to prevent militant attacks as the violence was escalating into an ethnic and sectarian conflict.
Parachinar's history is marked by the infiltration of militants that have launched assaults on local Shia communities, resulting in widespread bloodshed. These conflicts have often led to road closures, isolating residents and intensifying their hardships. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
IranRadio.ir. What you just heard was an Iraqi English radio program.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness, from thee. I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. A UN special committee has described the Israeli war on Gaza as genocidal, expressing deep alarm over the humanitarian crisis there. The recent UN report was issued amid incessant attacks and unchecked violence by the Israeli regime, especially in northern Gaza, where a weeks-long siege and another major offensive have claimed thousands of lives.
A special committee of the UN's Human Rights Office says Israel's war in Gaza is consistent with the characteristics of genocide. In its latest report, it pointed to mass civilian casualties and life-threatening conditions intentionally imposed by Israel on Palestinians since October 7 last year.
The developments in this report led this special committee to conclude that the policies and practices of Israel are consistent with the characteristics of genocide. The targeting of Palestinians as a group, the life-threatening conditions imposed on Palestinians in Gaza through warfare and restrictions on humanitarian aid resulting in physical destruction, increased miscarriages, and stillbirth are violations under international law. Civilians have been indiscriminately and disproportionately killed en masse in Gaza.
The UN committee criticized the regime for destroying vital water and sanitation systems, contaminating the environment, and inflicting long-term harm on future generations. The report highlighted that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. This is consistent with findings from the UN's Famine Review Committee, which warns that famine may already be occurring in Gaza.
Already in October, nearly 133,000 people faced catastrophic food insecurity, and the integrated phase food security phase classification released on 17th of October warned that under a reasonable worst-case scenario, a risk of famine existed for the whole of the Gaza Strip between November 2024 and April 2025.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised urgent alarms about the looming threat of famine in northern Gaza, highlighting the severe humanitarian crisis that continues to unfold in the besieged strip.
Famine is imminent, if not already happening, in the besieged north. And while we receive testimonies from people on the ground asking, begging for pieces of bread, for water, the United Nations remains denied access to this area.
As the humanitarian crisis deepens in Gaza, the world continues to stay silent over the Israeli genocide. The need for immediate intervention has never been more pressing now as the lives of countless civilians hang in the balance amid U.S.-Israeli genocidal war.
Let's have a look at tonight's guests for this edition of Spotlight. We have human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi, who's joining us from Houston, Texas. And joining us from Belfast, we have journalist, activist, and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, Mr. Fra Hughes.
Look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Naqvi in Houston. This recent UN Special Committee report has described the Israeli war on Gaza as genocidal, pointing to mass civilian casualties and life-threatening conditions that have intentionally been imposed by Israel on Palestinians since October 7th of last year. Break down this report for us, as by many accounts, nothing new is being revealed here.
Well, yes, I think... Nothing new is being revealed in this report, and not that the UN has been able to really practically do anything to end the genocide in Gaza and the war in Lebanon, but for the international community, and the UN does represent the international community, to keep reiterating that this is not just that this is genocide, and the committee really. The report by the UN committee goes into detail as to why it's a genocide, elaborating and really focusing on the fact that this is a deliberate attempt, and it is a deliberate attempt to starve the people of Gaza. It's a deliberate attempt to target innocent civilians, and not just that, but it is targeting a group of civilians, a certain particular group of civilians. This is how this war, this crime, this imposition of war on the Palestinians is being labeled and categorized as genocide. So the fact that they mentioned that there is starvation in Palestine goes on to show the effect that this war that has been imposed on the Palestinians has had. It has been catastrophic, meaning it has not only just that they are not focusing on just the military, the Zionist regime. As a matter of fact, not much harm has been caused to the military, but their main focus has been hospitals, as we saw in the past, has been schools, as we've seen in Lebanon. They are targeting buildings, residential buildings where people live. And we've seen the footages. We've seen how people have been devastated in this genocide. So this UN committee goes on to really elaborate on what those specific crimes are that leads to the categorization of this war to be labeled as a genocide.
Frahues, the UN committee criticized the regime for destroying vital water and sanitation systems, contaminating the environment, inflicting long-term harm on future generations, and using starvation as a weapon of war. In that regard, the UN's Famine Review Committee warns that famine may already be occurring in Gaza. Where does Israel's claims of self-defense and fighting the resistance go hand in hand with starving innocent civilians and children in Gaza?
Well, their call for using self-defense is nothing but a propaganda tool which is used for Western audiences. This whole idea that they were attacked out of the blue on the 7th of October 2023, that they have the right to seek revenge, which is basically what they're doing on the people of Gaza, is nothing but a smokescreen in order to carry out the greater Israel plan. Now, you're talking about starvation as a weapon of war. There is an Israeli, I don't know if he is a soldier or a politician, who recently said in a public forum that the people in the north of Gaza could surrender or starve. Now, this is the official position of the Zionist, apartheid, racist, fascist state, which has its foothold in the Ummah and in the Levant. I just like to call out people in the Levant who aren't actually coming to the aid of the people in Palestine and now in Lebanon. You have countries like Turkey, which are continuing to supply steel, which is used for armaments, tanks, and weapons in Israel. You have a land border crossing going through, I believe, Saudi Arabia and through Jordan to supply by land articles and equipment and potentially munitions that cannot be docked at Israeli ports because of the Ansarallah army and the Yemeni civil society trying to prevent this continued genocide in Gaza and now further afield in Lebanon. You have both Jordan, a sovereign nation with the border on historic Palestine, and you have Egypt under Sisi, a man who was put in power under an American and, I believe, an Israeli coup when they ousted the democratically elected leader Morsi, put him in jail, and subsequently let him die. So we have complicity across the Ummah outside of the axis of resistance. And you're talking about starving people in Gaza. I have some personal information on this because as director of Palestine Aid, a registered charity in the north of Ireland, we have been able to supply 9,000 people in Gaza since March 2024 with over 110,000 meals sourcing that food on the ground. And we're hearing reports from our unpaid volunteers on the ground that children are starving in southern Gaza, that people are going without food several days consecutive days. So they're using starvation as a weapon of war. They're using starvation as subjugation. And if we all simply take off the blinkers, see what's happening on the ground, look at the reality, this is total war from a totalitarian regime that is using ethnic cleansing and genocide to end what they consider to be their Palestinian problem by ending the Palestinian people, much like the white Europeans in North America eradicated the indigenous population. This is what the white Europeans in Israel are doing to different members of the Ummah in both Lebanon and in Gaza.
Right, Mr. Narvi, the honorary chief said that Israel is only allowing maybe around 30 trucks of life-sustaining aid into Gaza daily. That's a ridiculously low number. UNRWA has also raised urgent alarms about the looming threat of famine in northern Gaza. Can you tell us what you think are the motives behind what Israel is doing to the north of Gaza for the past month or so?
Well, Gaza has been under siege. Gaza is being bombed, has been being bombed. Gaza is not only under siege, but Israel is actively blocking any kind of aid to enter into Gaza. Also, medics are being specifically targeted. And there is an escalation of media censorship by social media companies here in the West as well. So not only is Israel besieging Gaza and ensuring that medical supplies or aid doesn't reach the people of Gaza, but it is also ensuring that that information is also not disseminated outside of Gaza, that the devastation that is happening in Gaza, it is being censored by social media now and also mainstream media. And so the Zionists are making sure and trying their best to oppress and suppress the Palestinians in every way possible. And this targeting of an indigenous population, which are the Palestinians in Palestine, amounts to genocide. The fact that they are using AI weapons that have the ability to target specific targets, that they are engineered in a way that they can focus on specific targets, and yet civilians are being massacred in Gaza. This is not self-defense. This is a clear case of genocide that the Zionists are committing, in spite of pressures and warnings by the international community, by the United Nations, and by the international courts of justices. The Zionist regime continues its bombardment and genocide on Gaza, and absolutely ignoring all resolutions of the UN, SE, and all impositions of by the international community on them. And this goes on to show that this arrogance that the Zionists are showing towards the international community, towards people of conscience throughout the world who have been coming out to protest, this shows that they are being supported by the U.S. empire. Without the support of the U.S. empire, it is not possible for a small country like a so-called occupied state like the Zionist regime, Israel, to be able to confront world leaders in the way that they have been confronting. So without the support of the U.S. empire, without the support of Germany, without the support of the U.K., the Zionist regime cannot contain so much pressure from the international world. The fact that they have been using bunker bombs on residential properties, that they are using their entire air force comprises of weaponry that has been given to them by the U.S. empire, by Elbit systems. This goes on to show the complicity of the U.S. empire in this devastation and genocide.
Farah, he was following up what Mr. Nafi was just addressing. Are you appalled at the international community's failure to end the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza? Basically, the same is unfolding in Lebanon, too. Where does this leave the credibility of international bodies such as the UN, who have failed Palestinians and are now failing the Lebanese people as well?
I think what it shows is the false narrative that we've heard since the inauguration of the United Nations in 1948. The first thing they did was actually give credence and accept the state of Israel, which was self-declared at that time and then brought into the United Nations. So it's quite possible to say that from 1948, there has been nothing but a talking shop and a sham. It is there in order to prosecute African leaders, and it's there to, someone said recently, a member of, I think it was the ICC or the ICJ, that he was told by senior Western diplomats that the ICC was there purely to bring charges against black African leaders and Putin specifically, that that's what it was designed for, that's what it's there for. So it's a total sham. It needs to be replaced. Hopefully with BRICS going forward, there'll be an opportunity to set up either a shadow United Nations that has real input from its sovereign members, and that it has the international will to employ international force to end genocides like we're witnessing in Gaza. And if I just briefly, the Clintons are visiting Belfast. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton was due to give a talk at Queen's University Belfast, where she is the Vice Chancellor. And Joe Kennedy, an American pro-Zionist senator, was supposed to give a talk in the Mandela Hall. Hundreds of people with Palestinian flags, Palestinian scarves, turned up at the university in order to try and prevent these war criminal people with bloodstained hands. When we remember Hillary Clinton saying, we came, we saw, he died, talking about Gaddafi in Libya. The people in Belfast came out in huge numbers and prevented Hillary Clinton from speaking, and they prevented Joe Kennedy from speaking. And Bill Clinton is in Belfast tonight, supposedly at a £5,000 per table dinner in Belfast, which is the subject of a mass protest at 7:30 this evening.
Right, and Mr. Hughes, I'm going to stay with you for this one. If no action is being taken and there's no accountability for Israel's crimes and violations, won't this just happen again and again, and it could even set a precedent for similar massacres to take place in the future?
Okay, well, I'm not going to suggest we forget about what's happening now. Look what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population of Palestine, where they murdered every man, woman, and child in the Deir Yassin village, which is beside the J1 corridor, which I visited many years ago. They then went on to the neighboring villages and towns and told the people if they didn't leave, they'd be massacred. That's 1948. Not one Israeli at that time was brought before any war tribunal or charged with war crimes. It happened again in 67. It happened in 73. It happened in 82 in Beirut. It has happened all the way through Zionist, racist, fascist Israeli policy from before 1948 up to the present day. If no one was charged in the past, and every single general and leader and political figure in Israel has been a member of the IOF, has had potentially murdered people or called on others to murder people on their behalf, why do we think it's suddenly going to change in 2024? No one was held accountable then, no one's being held accountable now, and no one was held accountable for the Hiroshima bombs, the Nagasaki bombs, the bombing of Dresden by the British towards the end of the Second World War in 1944. None of them were held responsible, and many of the Nazis who should have been brought to Nuremberg and should have been put against the wall and executed were taken to America, and some of them were kept for the Gladio secret policy that the Europeans and the Americans brought in after the Second World War in order to destabilize the countries that had been liberated by the Russians during the Second World War. So there's no accountability. People are actually used as potential tools for the imperialist machinations throughout Europe and throughout the world. Whoever was in charge of, was it Bush in Iraq? That's an illegal war. And Blair, that's an illegal war. They should be in front of the Hague, and they're not.
Right, and Mr. Navi, how is the inaction of some Arab regimes in the face of the genocide of war on Gaza contributed to the continued massacre of the Palestinians, and now spreading to the attacks on the Lebanese as well?
Well, the inaction and silence of especially the neighboring Arab regimes is because of which the siege on Gaza continues. It is because of the inaction of these Arab regimes that the U.S. empire and the Zionists as well are able to use the military bases that they have in Jordan, that they've been able to use their skies to bombard the innocent people in Gaza, and to also retaliate against Hezbollah's attacks as well. And so it is these Arab neighbors that have empowered the Zionist regime, not just through inaction, but also through active, direct material support, as we've seen. But I'd also like to add what the committee has mentioned. They have mentioned, and I'm going to read this off of the committee. The UN Special Committee ends their report by saying that upholding international law, ensuring accountability for violations rests squarely on all member states. A failure to do so weakens the very core of international legal system and sets a dangerous precedent, allowing atrocities to go unchecked. So the Arab states, as you mentioned, are responsible, but also member states such as the UK, such as the US empire, also have a responsibility towards their own people and towards international law, because these measures that international law, international courts have taken are binding upon all member states. And Israel being a member, it is binding upon them. And the inaction of the US empire alongside the UK, Germany, and other superpowers, this inaction is what has enabled the Zionists to be able to act without showing any regard to international law. And the power that they hold on these Arab governments, on these monarchies such as Saudi Arabia, fascist dictatorships such as Egypt, Jordan, the UAE, it is these countries that have empowered foreign militaries to have a hold on West Asia. Right now, we see a clear distinction, which is there is a group, which is the Axis of Resistance, that is fighting for the sovereignty of all Arabs, all Muslims, and all indigenous people of West Asia. And we see that the monarchies that are set in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, in Jordan, we see these monarchies actively supporting and helping the US empire, the Zionist regime, and their militaries. Without their support, the Zionist, the US empire, they don't stand a chance on the land of West Asia.
Farahi's, very briefly, if you may, what kind of an impact, because we're talking about the US's unequivocal support for Israel, what kind of an impact will a new administration have, given the fact that no matter all the differences that the two main political parties in America may have, they're always on the same page when it comes to their obedience towards the Zionist lobbies?
Yes, it remains to be seen what a Trump presidency will do when it comes to West Asia. He's already said he's going to end the war in Ukraine. He did stand on a platform in Michigan, one of the swing states, and he did say to the Palestinian and the Arab diaspora and the people that are that are born of the Islamic faith in that particular state, that he would bring an end to the war in West Asia and Gaza. I can only hope that he will do what he said he will do. He has an opportunity to have a legacy, to be the president who brought an end to the war, because it won't be peace, because it'll never be peace so long as the Zionist state exists in order to divide the Ummah.
All right, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi, joining us from Houston, Texas. Also to Farah Hughes, journalist, activist, and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joining us from Belfast. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Speaking at the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, the Republic of Azerbaijan, the U.S. climate envoy John Podesta claimed the fight for a cleaner, safer planet will not stop under a re-elected Donald Trump, even if some progress is reversed. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump has picked Lee Zeldin, a former New York congressman, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, vowing the appointment will ensure fair and swift deregulatory decisions by the regulator. Trump, who oversaw the rollback of more than 100 environmental rules when he last was U.S. president, said that Lee Zeldin was a true fighter for America First policies and that he will ensure fair and swift deregulatory decisions that will be enacted in a way to unleash the power of American businesses, while at the same time maintaining the highest environmental standards, including the cleanest air and water on the planet. Zeldin, a Republican who was in the House of Representatives until last year as a member of a New York district that covers part of Long Island, said the nomination was an honor and that he was looking forward to cutting red tape as the Environmental Protection Agency's administrator. Zeldin wrote on X, "We will restore U.S. energy dominance, revitalize our auto industry, to bring back American jobs and make the U.S. a global leader of AI. He added, "We will do so whilst protecting access to clean air and water." Lee Zeldin, a 44-year-old, is considered a close Donald Trump ally. He ran in a surprisingly close race for New York governor in 2022 before being pipped by Kathy Hochul, a Democrat. During the campaign, Zeldin attacked Hochul's far-left climate agenda and assailed Democrats for allegedly forcing people to drive electric cars. The Environmental Protection Agency nominee, who will have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, has rarely spoken out on environmental or climate issues, although he said back in 2014 he was not sold yet on the whole argument that we have a serious problem, as other people are, with global warming, and added in 2018 that he did not support the Paris Climate Accord, which Donald Trump is expected to withdraw from. Zeldin, who has a score of just 14% from the League of Conservation Voters on his votes on environmental issues in his 15 years in Congress, is expected to oversee an overhaul of the Environmental Protection Agency that will rival anything seen since its foundation in 1970. An exodus of staff is expected from the agency, with employees already raising fears they will be subject to political interference and that their work to protect Americans from toxic chemicals and planet-heating emissions from cars, trucks and power plants will be torn up. Ben Jealous, executive director of the Sierra Club, said Zeldin's nomination, naming an unqualified anti-American worker who opposes efforts to safeguard our clean air and water, lays bare Donald Trump's intentions to once again sell our health, our communities, our jobs and our future out to corporate polluters. Ben Jealous added, "Our lives, our livelihoods and our collective future cannot afford Lee Zeldin or anyone who seeks to carry out a mission antithetical to the EPA's mission." The naming of Lee Zeldin less than a week after Donald Trump won the presidential election is far quicker than his previous term in the White House, when he took until December to name Scott Pruitt as his pick for the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Pruitt resigned in 2018 amid a flurry of ethics scandals, including allegations that he gave staffers improper pay rises. National broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Speaking at the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, the Republic of Azerbaijan, America's climate envoy John Podesta claimed the fight for a cleaner, safer planet will not stop under a re-elected Donald Trump, even if some progress is reversed. John Podesta, who is leading the Biden administration's delegation at the annual talk, said, Although under Donald Trump's leadership, the U.S. federal government placed climate-related actions on the back burner, efforts to prevent climate change remain a commitment in the United States and will confidently continue. Trump has pledged to deregulate the energy sector, allow the oil and gas industry to drill, baby, drill, and pull the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, which committed countries to taking steps to avoid the worst impacts of the crisis. John Podesta said, "While Trump will try to reverse progress, this is not the end of our fight for a cleaner, safer planet." The recent re-election of Trump to the White House, which will see him inaugurated for a second term in January, has cast a shadow on the United Nations talks after a Republican defeated Kamala Harris. Harris had been expected to continue the climate policies of Joe Biden, who passed the Inflation Reduction Act, the largest down payment on the green transition seen in U.S. history. Experts say Trump's second term could be even more destructive, as he will be aided by an amenably conservative judiciary and armed with detailed policy blueprints such as the Project 2025 document published by the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Donald Trump's incoming administration is already reportedly drawing up executive orders to erase climate policies and open up protected land for ramped-up oil and gas production. President-elect Trump said on Wednesday, 6th of November, "We have more liquid gold than any country in the world." Staff at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, which was targeted the last time Trump was president, are already bracing for a mass exodus. Much of the work done by the EPA staff under Biden, such as pollution rules for cars and power plants, as well as efforts to protect vulnerable communities living near industrial activity, are set to be reversed. A June analysis warned that Trump's forthcoming rollbacks could add 4 billion additional metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere by 2030, when compared with the continuation of Joe Biden's policies. Jamie Minden, the 21-year-old acting executive director of Zero Hour, the U.S.-based youth-led climate nonprofit organization, at a press conference about the election results in Baku, Republic of Azerbaijan, on Monday said, "That would be a death sentence for our planet." Todd Stern, who was the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change and the United States' chief negotiator at the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, said, "Trump's looming presidency could also place a damper on other countries' climate action plans." Todd Stern said, "The two biggest players in the ring are the United States and China is extremely aware of that. It has just got a guarantee that the U.S. president won't be bringing up climate change with them for the next 4 years, and that means something. It will make things easier on China, and that can't help but have some impact." Todd Stern added, "Yet the fight is bigger than one election, one political cycle in one country. The UN climate conference in Baku represents a critical opportunity to cement our progress." At the COP29 summit in Baku, activists are pushing the Biden administration to file a bold climate plan under the Paris Climate Agreement, known as a nationally determined contribution, and to make big pledges to support global climate finance efforts. Ali Rosenbluth, co-manager of the climate non-governmental organization Oil Change International, said, "And President Biden still has critical opportunities to cement his climate legacy on the domestic level as well, including by rejecting pending permits for fossil fuel projects."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A blinding flash of white light. the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hezbollah continues to pound Israel's military bases, settlements and forces with missiles and drones in retaliation for the regime's aggression against Lebanon. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a new operation against Israel, hitting a vital target in Eilat port with drones. Iran warns that it will take new measures if the International Atomic Energy Agency issues a resolution against the country in its upcoming meeting. The The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out fresh retaliatory operations against the Israeli regime. Hezbollah launched a rocket barrage against the administrative headquarters of the Golani Brigade in northwest of the occupied territories. Three naval bases in the north